This time, we look for the picture of God in the book of Daniel. But first of all, a most interesting question came all the way from Zaire. And I'd like maybe to comment on that before we go on with Daniel. The return mailing address is Ndola Ndola, I believe it's pronounced, in Zambia, because apparently mail from Zaire goes best through Zambia nearby. And a friend over there who works with a relief agency writes that last night we started the new God in All 66 at our place. That is the tapes that we're producing together here. Said there was enthusiastic response, lively discussion. It's a mixed group, including a grammar school dropout, PhDs, domestic, university professors, missionaries, and others. It's a multinational group, American, Canadian, British, Dutch, French, Mauritian, Zambian, and Zairean, multi-ethnic. She mentions at least seven, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Zairean tribes represented, multilingual. English is second or maybe seventh language for most. And it includes several denominations, Methodist, Anglican, Plymouth Brethren, others to come, and so on. But they've caught the basic questions, she writes, what does this say about God? But immediately at the first meeting, introduction meeting, they ran into this question. Why did God put the tree in the garden? It came up when Euphrasy, hope I pronounced her name correctly, challenged us to help her understand why, if God knew Adam and Eve would sin, why did he put that tree in the garden and tell them not to eat from it? Or why, if he is a loving God, didn't he invent some other kind of punishment instead of death? And she adds, you no doubt encountered the African concept that everything good or bad is caused by someone, either living or dead. Therefore, God caused sin because he created Lucifer and so on. The other members of the group tried to answer Euphrasy, but the picture of God approach is new for all of them. I just sat back and smiled and finally said, read on, Euphrasy. It wasn't the moment to add, it'll get worse. But next week, we're going to do Genesis. We frequently hear variations of Euphrasy's question. She and the others plan to follow the entire series. For example, Bulaku lives across town and brought his bedroll to sleep on his office floor just so he could be here, and so on. Well, what can one say about the question? The first one, why would God punish them so severely for taking the fruit off that tree? Well, we discussed this a little bit, and maybe we should say we'll read on into Genesis. We'll discuss it there. But she had listened ahead to Genesis and felt maybe we should have said more. Did God say, obey me or I'll kill you? Or was he saying, if you do not do things my way, the consequence would be death? Could you trust and love and be friendly with a God who would say, do what I say, even be my friend, or I'll have to kill you? And it's a very fundamental question. In fact, it's a real 66-book question. And following our policy, of course, I wouldn't want to say the answer is as follows. I really do believe one ought to read on, because a great deal more is coming on this subject. For example, we'll do Hosea next time. And there's a wonderful illustration there of what God does to those for whom he can do nothing more. Now, it is significant that Adam and Eve did not die at once, precisely as the adversary said in the garden. Had he therefore lied to them? If so, then God cannot be trusted. So we read all the way on to Romans 3, 24 and 25 and 26, and then through there, a long time yet to come, and there is an explanation of why Jesus had to die. He died to demonstrate God's righteousness. If he isn't righteous, you wouldn't trust him. You wouldn't want to be his friend. Because in his divine forbearance, he had apparently overlooked men's former sin. This was to show that he himself is righteous and therefore can be trusted, and so on. So the answer is yet to come. But even then, why associate something so severe as death with sin? Sin pays its wage, the wage is death. And this is where I would suggest that some might care to read the book, Servants or Friends, Another Look at God, because we discussed the difference there. Servants look at these words, eat of that fruit and you'll die, as a threat of punishment. Friends look at it in another way. To servants, what's dangerous about sin is that it angers the master, and there would be severe punishment in the end, even execution, even eternal torment. The friend would say, what's dangerous about sin is what it does to the sinner. It so changes the sinner that left to himself, he will die. I think the only thing to do is to go on reading and see if there's any more evidence for this. The two choices, though, would be very significant. Because if it's true that God said, my punishment for disobeying me is that I will have to kill you or I will have to torture you for eternity, then I think all talk of friendship, freedom, love, trust are gone. But is there any other way to understand this? Well, for that we would have to read on and see what God has done. And it does seem that later on that Jesus came and died in a certain way to demonstrate what the answer is to this question. Sin pays its wage and the wage is death. So I hope folk will be willing to wait and read on. Yes.
Some years back, as I first started coming and listening to your classes, because this was a different way to look at things, of course, and I was new to it, I wanted answers immediately. Mm-hmm. And every time you raised a question, so often you would leave it as a question, and I'm going, but I didn't get the answer. I want the answer now, you have to understand. Mm-hmm. And yet, by being in and going through and studying it book by book and pulling pieces together, the best way is not to have one person say, here are the answers, but by leading people through and continually asking questions, they start solving it. Sometimes some things are left unanswered. Wait until we go through the whole thing. The answers do come.
Because if you make a selection of texts here or there that deal with the subject and present that as your argument, how does the hearer know but that you've picked the ones that support mm-hmm. your own position? Mm-hmm. Someone else could come with another collection of texts, with another explanation. That's why I decided for myself back in the 40s, I had to do this all the way through for myself, nobody telling me which verses or how to interpret them. And it all seemed to come together in a certain way, which means a lot to me. But I've got to allow other people to have that same experience. And it does take a little time. The other question that goes with it is, why the tree? I mean, why would he almost seem to tempt them, allow the adversary to come and tempt them to do this thing? Well, it is significant to note that it was at this tree, and God warned them to stay away from it, at least not take the fruit from it. That's the place where Satan met them. Now, it doesn't say Satan, but over in Revelation 12, it identifies the serpent as Satan, the devil, the adversary, and so on. And we're reminded of the war that began up in heaven. And here is this adversary appearing in the garden, and he appears at the tree. And there he lies about God. He said, God has lied to you, you will not die. He's a selfish God, and he's withholding something good from you. And Jesus himself commented on the adversary in John 8 by saying he's the father of lies. His whole goal is to undermine trust in God. So to me it's significant that in the story, the adversary meets them at the tree that God had advised them to avoid. Is it possible, in terms of 1 Corinthians 10:13, that this is another case of God not allowing a person to be tested more than he's able to bear, using some of the old words there, that in a way, this was to protect them? I mean, in their inexperience, they were no match for the adversary, who had already led one-third of the angels to decide against God, as the book of Revelation speaks. He could easily have overwhelmed these two inexperienced, newly created people, and so God restricted him to that one place. In that case, the tree would not be a test or a trap. It would actually be a protection. Mm-hmm. Would that seem to have any evidence accumulating as to a legitimate possibility?
That way he couldn't hound them. No. Appear as an angel of light somewhere else in the garden, and they'd have no clue. Well, is this God, or is this the person we've been told about?
Now, an interesting question there in the interest of fairness, did God hide this tree in some distant corner of the garden where no one could see it? It does say in the midst of the garden.
Well, in order to have, to make, to have the freedom to choose, yeah. you have to be able to choose between mm-hmm. something. If it's good, good, and good, what are your choices? Good.
It did allow the adversary an opportunity, in fairness, but it warned them not to go there. They would have to go to the tree of life, and apparently they weren't far away from each other.
He set up the guidelines, though, explaining, here's where you'll get into trouble.
No.
Don't go off by yourselves. And they ignored that. And so there were consequences to that. But it wasn't like he didn't tell them the game plan or the rules or anything, and somehow there was a trap set.
So had they followed God's advice, they would not have been confronted by their wily foe, it would appear. At least, there is a good alternative to the idea that he just arbitrarily said, you can eat all the others, but not this one. But rather, it was to protect them. And I see that for all his restrictions. They were for our best good, because this is the God who desires our freedom and values it more highly than anything else. But then I think we should look through and see if there aren't more illustrations of this. Brings us then to the book of Daniel this time, to the 12 chapters of Daniel. All depends what version you've brought. I have one very widely circulated Bible called the New American Bible, which is a Roman Catholic translation. And there are many others like it, and Catholic biblical translation is of great quality. And you look at the book of Daniel, and you find that it has 14 chapters. So shall we discuss the 14, or shall we discuss the 12? If you use the New American Bible, or the Jerusalem Bible, or the Rems-Douay version, or any of these other Catholic translations, when you come to chapter 3, you find, how many verses do you have in the good news you've brought in chapter 3 of Daniel?
30.
You have only 30? Mm-hmm. Oh, in the New American Bible there are 100. Because after the three Hebrew worthies, as they're sometimes called, were thrown into the burning fiery furnace, they uttered quite a prayer. And there's a footnote. It's about verses 24 to 90. These verses are inspired additions to the Aramaic text of Daniel, translated from the Greek form of the book. They were originally composed in Hebrew or Aramaic, which has not been preserved. The church has always regarded them as part of the canonical scriptures. So to our Catholic friends, this is part of the canonical scriptures, and they would want to include the song of the three Hebrew worthies in the fire. And then when you come to chapter 12, lo, there's a 13 and a 14. And chapter 13 is the remarkable story we mentioned once before about Susanna. You remember the two witnesses who both agreed that she had been found misbehaving in the garden with a young man? And Daniel called each of the men to the stand separately and said, under which tree in the garden did you see this happening? And they couldn't agree on the tree. And he proved that even in the mouth of two witnesses, you can have lies. That's chapter 13. It's quite a story. Then chapter 14 is the story of Bel and the dragon. Very interesting stories. But it includes one little detail that I've always found particularly amusing. Did you ever wonder how Daniel got any food in the lion's den? Well, it's told here in this, what's called sometimes the deuterocanonical version of Daniel. Oh, let me look at in the 14th chapter here, verse 33. In Judea, there was a prophet Habakkuk. We have him coming up a little later. He mixed some bread in a bowl with the stew he had boiled and was going to bring it to the reapers in the field when an angel of the Lord told him, take the lunch you have to Daniel in the lion's den at Babylon. But Habakkuk answered, Babylon, sir, I have never seen, and I do not know the den. The angel of the Lord seized him by the crown of his head and carried him by the hair. With the speed of the wind, he set him down in Babylon above the den. Daniel, Daniel, cried Habakkuk, take the lunch God has sent you. And I can see him drawing up his legs and his feet, you know, as he got closer and closer. And Daniel replied, you have remembered me, O God, said Daniel. You have not forsaken those who love you. While Daniel began to eat, the angel of the Lord at once brought Habakkuk back to his own place. And so on. A little detail you will not find in the traditional Hebrew scriptures, but is in Roman Catholic translations that include the Apocrypha.
What is the reason for including those?
Well, it's a long tradition in the Greek Old Testament. It's a longer form, like the additions to Esther and the books of Maccabees and 1st and 2nd Esdras and so on. The roughly 14 fragments or whole books were developed during the intertestamental period. And the Bible that was circulated in Greek, largely, in the times of early Christianity, the Greek Bible, Old and New Testament, contained these extra books. So people had to make interesting decisions, as we discussed in our introductory session, about which books were to be regarded as authentic. There were even New Testament books floating around. And you remember I mentioned the story of John and the bedbugs and how Peter made a camel go through the eye of a needle, and how Simon attracted people to his meetings by flying over Rome and so on. There were those stories circulating in writing, and eventually the traditional 66 came together, the so-called Protestant canon. Luther was faced with this question, and he gathered these stories in the Old Testament and put them in the middle with a little note: these stories are interesting and useful, but not for doctrine. The church responded at the Council of Trent, these extra books are dependable for doctrine. So when you meet with a Catholic friend, remember there may be more information in his Bible, and it's good to have read it, be acquainted with it. But now, Babylon, and we're using the shorter version, as it were, the one that the Orthodox Jews would regard as the authentic Old Testament. It begins, in the third year of the reign of King Jehoiakim of Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. That throws us back into Isaiah and Jeremiah and Chronicles and Ezra and Nehemiah and so on, you remember? The Lord let King Jehoiakim of Judah fall into his power, as well as some of the vessels of the house of God. These he brought to the land of Shinar and placed the vessels in the treasury of his gods. Then the king commanded his palace master, Ashpenaz, to bring some of the Israelites of the royal family and of the nobility, young men without physical defect and handsome, versed in every branch of wisdom, endowed with knowledge and insight, and competent to serve in the king's palace. They were to be taught the literature and language of the Chaldeans. Notice they were already well-educated and gifted before they began their years of training in Babylon. The king assigned them a daily portion of the royal rations of food and wine. They were to be educated for 3 years, so that at the end of that time they could be stationed in the king's court. Among them were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, elsewhere known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, from the tribe of Judah. The palace master gave them other names. Oh, here they are. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called, it's not Abednego to them, but that's how we anglicize it now. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the royal rations or rations of food and wine, so he asked the palace master to allow him not to defile himself. Note, defile has religious connotations more than health, perhaps. Defile himself. Now God allowed Daniel to receive favor and compassion from the palace master. The palace master said to Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king. He has appointed your food and your drink. If he should see you in poorer condition than the other young men of your own age, you would endanger my head with the king. Then Daniel asked the guard, whom the palace master had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat. What do you have in the good news? Remember, King James was pulse, vegetables to eat, vegetables, and water to drink. You can then compare our appearance with the appearance of the young men who eat the royal rations and deal with your servants according to what you observe. There he seems to be concerned about health. Mm-hmm. Maybe the two are mixed in an interesting way. So he agreed to this proposal and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, this is better than some of the claims on television for weight loss and so on. At the end of 10 days, it was observed that they appeared better and fatter. Oh, dear, I should have mentioned weight loss, should I? Better and fatter. You know, in the Bible, it's not considered a blessing to be slender. If you're being blessed of God, you are well-rounded. better and fatter than all the young men who had been eating the royal rations. So the guard continued to withdraw their royal rations and the wine they were to drink, and gave them vegetables. To these four young men God gave knowledge and skill in every aspect of literature and wisdom. Daniel also had insight into all visions and dreams, which leads to the first remarkable interpretation of one of the king's dreams. Why do you think he didn't want to eat this food? He does mention health, but he also mentions being defiled and so on.
Wasn't it offered to idols?
It was offered to idols. There are other references to food being offered to idols, and it does seem that the heathen deities were rarely vegetarians. So it tended to be the meat and the wine offered to the idols. And Paul brings this up in Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 8 and 10, and there's more of it in Romans 14, where there was a real argument in the early church that if you went to the market and ate what was for sale, and Paul says, eat whatever you find in the meat market. King James shambles. If you go to the city of York in England, you see the street called the Shambles, and that's where all the butcher shops are. You can see them right there. Shambles are butcher shops. He said, eat whatever you find in the butcher shops without raising any question on the ground of conscience. But if someone should say to you, this food was offered to idols, then don't eat it. For conscience sake, his conscience, not yours, because you know that that food being offered to idols is not affected at all. Anyway, we should save that all until we get to Corinthians and Romans, and it's very fascinating. It occupies a lot of space. It was such a great controversy in the church. What's so interesting to me is that here Daniel is saying, I will not defile myself by eating the food offered to idols, because it would even seem, too, that I'm recognizing the idols. In Corinthians and Romans, Paul is saying, show your rejection of the idols by eating this food. Offering it, you know, doesn't affect your health at all. And so Paul says over there, the man who has strong faith can eat anything, but the man who is weak in faith eats only vegetables. Would you say Daniel was weak in faith? Just the opposite. So it's so interesting to me that the situation is reversed here between Daniel and the early century when Paul was writing. So here I'm sure he would agree with Daniel. Don't eat it. Show your rejection of the idols. In Corinthians he says, do eat it. Show your rejection of the idols. Sometimes that's called situation ethics. That means making an ethical decision in the light of the situation. Well, so long as it's done honestly in the light of the whole situation, well and good. But that's a colorful beginning to the book. Then there is this first dream that the king has, you remember. And he calls in the Chaldeans and demands that they tell him what the dream is about. And when the Chaldeans came in chapter 2, verse 4, they said to the king, now my New Revised Standard actually has in brackets, in Aramaic. Mm-hmm. What do you have in yours?
Aramaic.
King James has maybe Syriac, sometimes Aramaic, sometimes Syriac, sometimes Chaldean. That doesn't matter. The interesting thing is that these wise men came and said in this other language, O king, live forever. And if you can read these two languages, they don't look very different from each other. The same alphabet is used. But it does switch here into Aramaic. Do you remember when the Jews came back from Babylonian captivity and Ezra, we had this earlier, read the scriptures to them? And they couldn't understand the Hebrew, and so individuals mingled with the crowd and translated for them from the Hebrew to the Aramaic. And you remember letters that were sent from Palestine back to Babylon? They were written in Aramaic. So the Jews changed their languages. The language of Scripture is still Hebrew, except for those parts of Scripture that were written in Aramaic, because the writer here naturally puts the words of the Chaldeans in Aramaic. O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will reveal the interpretation. The king answered the Chaldeans, and the writer doesn't go back to Hebrew. In fact, he doesn't go back to Hebrew till the end of chapter 7. Do you have a note to that effect in the footnote?
Oh, yes.
And that's why we have a whole section in Aramaic, as we had a section in Ezra, you remember. Then comes the furnace story. And you remember, he looked in the fire and he saw someone who looked like, in 325, who was walking with the three? King James says, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. What would he mean, like the Son of God? Had the young men shown him a photograph of the Son of God? So he said, well, it looks just like the picture you gave me. How could you say he looks like the Son of God? And so you probably don't have that in your translation. What does it say in 325?
The fourth one looks like an angel.
Looks like an angel?
The footnote.
Footnote says, or a son of the gods, or a son of God.
Yes, a son of the gods is literal. He looks like a divine being. Let me see what this one has. In 325 in the New American, in the New Revised Standard. But he replied, but I see four men unbound walking in the middle of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the fourth has the appearance of a god. Little g. So he had some feeling that the fourth one was a divine person. But to say he recognized the Son of God personally from perhaps some earnest teaching from these Jews to convert King Nebuchadnezzar to faith in Christ, he didn't know what he looked like. But he could well have assumed, say, the form of the fourth. You've talked about this friend of yours. So I'd like to know what was in Nebuchadnezzar's mind when he said, the form of the fourth is like a god or a son of God. Most significant to me, though, with respect to our whole orientation of, one, we want to find the picture of God. Number two, we know from what Jesus said is that the God of the Bible would rather treat us as understanding friends. Is there anything in this experience that really does pertain to our question, what kind of a person is God? What does he like? What is he not like? You notice in chapter 3, verse 6, this monarch whom God has treated with great respect, it would seem. In 3, verse 6, what does he know about freedom? Nebuchadnezzar says, whoever does not fall down and worship this image which he had set up to resemble, you remember, in the first image, the head was made of gold, and Daniel says that represents Babylon. So he builds an image all of gold. He doesn't want any other empires coming after, as it would appear. The whole image is of gold. And he says, you fall down and worship, or you will be immediately thrown into a furnace of burning fire. That rather brings up the question that came from Zaire, it seems to me. God says, you obey me, or I'll kill you. And later on, you go through the Bible to find out what he will do, and he says he will kill you, and you come all the way to the last book, which would seem to be the place to get the last word on this subject. And God says, if you do not obey me in my wrath, I will pour out sulfur and brimstone and burn you forever and ever. Now will you be my friend? Now will you obey me? Does not God sometimes sound like a divine Nebuchadnezzar? Did Nebuchadnezzar stay this way? Well, look at 2:12 to see where he began in granting freedom to people. What did he want done to these Chaldeans who couldn't help him? 2:12. Because of this, because they couldn't help him remember the dream he had forgotten, because of this, the king flew into a violent rage and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. And you read over in the book of Revelation, God will pour out his rage, his wrath without mixture, and they'll be tormented in sulfurous flames forever and ever. They seem to be rather alike. And then Daniel comes along, who knows God, and seemed to have a wonderful relationship with God. And he says, please don't do it. Reasons with this king who had total, absolute power to command whatever he wanted. He said, please don't. In 2:24, Daniel says, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Don't do it. Please let me help you. And then we come to 3 verse 6. Nebuchadnezzar is very impressed that someone has come to rescue them. And he thinks, perhaps, maybe this is the divine person that Daniel has such confidence in. You remember, he said, my God says, remember, he has shown me the dream, and he will show you the meaning of the dream. He seemed to be close with God, and he wonders if maybe the form of the fourth, maybe it's this person. So Nebuchadnezzar is so impressed with the faith of these three and with this fourth person, whoever he is, that he decides that maybe it would be better if the people would worship this god. So he writes, having said in 3:6, if you will not worship my golden image, I'll throw you into the fire. He then says in 3:28 and 29, I make a decree. Any people, nation, or language that utters blasphemy against the god of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, shall be torn limb from limb. Now, I've heard folk speak of the wonderful effect on Nebuchadnezzar when he came face to face with a divine being, a friend of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. In a way, he was rather converted to this new god, and he felt that everybody else should regard this new god with great respect. This is how you win it. Anyone of any people, nation, or language that utters blasphemy against this god shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other god who is able to deliver in this way. And some say, isn't that wonderful? Nebuchadnezzar was won to the truth. No, he just switched gods and so on, and his attitude is still the same. So then you read on into chapter 4, where you remember another dream and its explanation, and how Nebuchadnezzar really came under humbling discipline, didn't he, in chapter 4. In 4:2 and 3, well, let's read these first, 2 and 3. Nebuchadnezzar sent a message to all the people, and in which he is going to tell of how God treated him and how God humbled him, isn't it? It's the whole account of chapter 4. He writes to the people and says, may you have abundant prosperity. The signs and wonders that the Most High God has worked for me, I am pleased to recount, which he is about to do. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his sovereignty is from generation to generation. And he tells what happened to him. And you remember the story of how he was humbled and was on his knees eating grass like an animal. So now that he's duly humbled, you come down to his final words in verse 34. And is he going to say, now I have a better picture of God, and I command you to accept this one? When that period was over, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me. And I uttered a decree that anybody who would not accept this God shall be torn limb from limb. No, I just blessed the Most High and praised and honored the one who lives forever. For his sovereignty is an everlasting sovereignty, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does what he wills with the host of heaven and the inhabitants of the earth. There is no one who can stay his hand or say to him, what are you doing? At that time my reason returned to me, and my majesty and splendor were restored to me for the glory of my kingdom. My counselors and my lord sought me out. I was reestablished over my kingdom, and still more greatness was added to me. Now he has one last chance to tell everybody like he used to. Now you better obey and worship the true God. His closing words are, now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are truth, and his ways are justice. And he is able to bring low those who walk in pride. He really had changed, don't you? Or do you agree? I see quite a progression there for Nebuchadnezzar. Do you anticipate seeing him in the hereafter, perhaps? If so, where? He came a long way for a man who had divine right of kings and could do whatever he wants, have whatever he wants. So nothing wrong with saying, if you can't help me, you wise men, may you all be put to death, and if you won't worship my God, you'll be thrown into the burning fiery furnace, and so on. What a change in the end. His picture of God quite changed. What do you think?
And seemingly thanked God for it. I mean, instead of complaining.
Isn't that a good point?
Because he recognizes, you know, but
I'm pleased to recount what he did. Do you suppose he got the idea, whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, coming up later, and he showed the good results of such discipline. Though with a king, you'd like Nebuchadnezzar, you'd have to use rather extraordinary measures, which the Lord did. I like to watch that change in there. What do you think about God saying, though, if you will not obey me, I will throw you into the burning fiery lake of hell fire? What about that?
Well, there's a little difference there. Nebuchadnezzar couldn't keep these people alive in the furnace. What we're saying is that God can keep you alive in his furnace to really suffer.
Would you agree that it was wrong for Nebuchadnezzar to force people to worship under threat of eternal? Well, no, not eternal at all. Just a quick death in the hot fire. Yeah. And he'd make it so hot you wouldn't live much. Remember the people that threw them in?
Died.
Died right there. Yeah. That's what fire does, isn't
quick.
It?
It would have been quick.
Yeah.
Did they recognize that? The soldiers that had to throw them in? That isn't a job you'd want to volunteer for?
I don't know. They probably
were amazed that the three didn't die just as quickly in the fire.
They probably thought it had misjudged the heat, maybe, and got up there and it.
He made it seven times hotter, it says. Well, we don't approve of Nebuchadnezzar saying, obey me even in the realm of religion. Worship the true God that Nebuchadnezzar trusted in at the time, or you will be thrown into the burning fiery furnace. And then God comes along and says, you worship me, or I'll throw you into the burning fiery furnace and you'll burn forever. And you say, for to Nebuchadnezzar, that's very wrong of you to do that. But to God, that's perfectly just. How do you put the two together?
You look at the meaning in what God is saying.
Don't you think
the
it's a fair
comparison? The meaning is quite clear for Nebuchadnezzar.
Yeah. And some would reply, very reverently to be sure, well, anything that God does is right. And you say, well, that doesn't make sense. And they say, well, we're now in the realm of religion, and religion doesn't have to make sense. I'd be afraid to trust something that didn't make some sense. But the Bible seems full of God saying, you either obey me, or you will be burned to death or burned forever. And then you look up what it means to obey, and Moses said to obey the Ten Commandments is to love God and love your neighbor as yourself. And 1 John says that sin is violating God's will. So does God say, love me or I'll throw you into the burning fiery furnace? At least Nebuchadnezzar made sense. He didn't say, love me. Tell me how much you love me or I'll throw you into the burning fiery furnace. He knew that wouldn't make any sense. He just said, you get down on your knees. That's what you say to servants. You can force people to be your servants. But God says, I'd rather you be my friends. I want you to love me. Tell me that you love me, or I'll throw you into the burning fiery furnace and keep you alive for eternity. It would seem to make no sense whatever. Why does that still have such an appeal? At least it's worth raising the question, isn't it, as we go along? It means that when we come to the place that talks about the wicked burning forever and ever, we'd have to look at that in a consistent way and be honest with the words. And does the Bible have an explanation of this that makes sense? We should watch for it.
And does God say he will kill you, or that if you don't obey him, you will die?
Well, now we're back to the Genesis question once again.
Well, and if I say to my 2-year-old, yeah, if you go run out into the street, you will be killed, am I going to force the car that hits her to kill her, or are those the consequences? Will she be killed? Am I just pronouncing it?
So I think it's a very legitimate question in Genesis, and that people should take it very seriously and read on and see if the Bible offers any explanation. And in the biblical way, it'll not be just words of explanation. It will be demonstration. We must surely someday see somebody die the death of a person who does not trust God, has become an unhealable rebel and totally disorderly in his life, to see that death demonstrated. Of course, the temptation is to mention the text that appealed to you, you know. I can't help but remember Paul's explanation that Christ was made to be sin, though he knew no sin, and he died the death of a sinner. Is that the one we should look at? But then we have to wait clear over at least to the Gospels and see how Jesus died on Calvary and almost in Gethsemane, and wait for that till we get there. Well, then comes Belshazzar, and the bloodless hand, and those interesting words on the wall. Daniel's faithfulness that led him to his being thrown into the lion's den. And we learn from the Apocrypha how he was fed with Habakkuk's lunch. And then we have the four beasts and the horns. And the four beasts seem to resemble the image, don't they, in chapter 2, maybe these same great world kingdoms. And, of course, some are named, which gives us the invitation to think of world empires. Isn't that true? And then in chapter 7, there's apparently a picture of a heavenly court scene with millions watching when the court sits in judgment and the books are open. And then in chapter 8, it talks about the sanctuary being and how this is translated in various ways. The Hebrew could perhaps best be translated, the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state, set right, because something has gone wrong there. Of course, that's where the war began, was it not, up in heaven? And then the remarkable prediction about the 70 weeks and the 70 years, of course, of Jeremiah. And then the difficult chapter 11, about which there is endless debate. And then the final chapter, which predicts final triumph and victory. Speaking of the historical setting for this, let's look at that Daniel 9, which we looked at before when we were in Jeremiah and in Ezra and Nehemiah. In the first year of Darius, son of Ahasuerus, by birth a Mede, who became king over the realm of the Chaldeans, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, perceived in the books the number of years that, according to the word of the Lord to the prophet Jeremiah, must be fulfilled for the devastation of Jerusalem, namely 70 years. So Daniel, the prophet, is dealing with the prophecy made by Jeremiah. Then I turned to the Lord God to seek an answer by prayer and supplication with fasting and sackcloth and ashes. I prayed to the Lord my God and made confession, saying, Ah, Lord, great and awesome God, keeping covenant and steadfast love with those who love you and keep your commandments. And of course, we feel greatly motivated to love you and keep your commandments, because if we don't, we know we'll be thrown into the burning fiery furnace. It doesn't fit there too well, does it? But an agreement that was made with Abraham and his children. We have sinned and done wrong, acted wickedly and rebelled, turning aside from your commandments and ordinances. We have not listened to your servants, the prophets, who spoke in your name to our kings, our princes, and our ancestors, and to all the people of the land. Righteousness is on your side, O Lord, but open shame as it this day falls on us, the people of Judah, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and all Israel, those who are near and those who are far away, in all the lands to which you have driven them. And that includes the 10 tribes to the north. They were scattered into many lands because of the treachery that they have committed against you. Now, that's another explanation for what sin is then. Sin is treachery. Sin is being an untrustworthy person, a traitor. Open shame, O Lord, falls on us, our kings, our officials, and our ancestors, because we have sinned against you. To the Lord our God belong mercy and forgiveness, for we have rebelled against him and have not obeyed the voice of the Lord our God by following his laws, which he set before us by his servants, the prophets. Among them was Moses, who said, to keep the commandments is to love. All Israel has transgressed your law and turned aside, refusing to obey your voice. So the curse and the oath written in the law of Moses, the servant of God, have been poured out upon us because we have sinned against you. And Moses predicted in detail, didn't he, that this sort of thing would happen. And so it is happening. And so while to some, I'm sure, it undermined trust in God, the fact that everything happened as predicted did not undermine Daniel's trust in God. It only confirmed his trust. Does that remind us of the words of Jesus? I tell you these things beforehand so that when they happen, you'll trust. Which may be the key to the whole of Daniel. Why does God make all these predictions? What's the value of predictive prophecy? To many, it's an opportunity to work out a schedule of all the future events so they can have it all marked out, knowing exactly when everything's going to happen, except that we keep changing those days, don't we? In your lifetime, haven't you seen some of the days change? Well, here's Daniel saying, you did exactly what you said you would. And it's our fault, not yours. We didn't have to do these things that we did. We have been untrusting and untrustworthy. We have been treacherous. And we did not heed what Moses said. And so, lo and behold, everything's happened exactly as you said it would. Don't you think Daniel here is sort of introducing the purpose of his own predictions later on? All Israel has transgressed your law, and the curse of written in the book of Moses has been poured out upon us. So verse 12, he has confirmed his words, you see, which he spoke against us and against our rulers, by bringing upon us a calamity so great that what has been done against Jerusalem has never before been done under the whole heaven. See the idea of the event confirming the prediction, and therefore the trustworthiness of the one who made the prediction. Just as it is written in the law of Moses, all this calamity has come upon us. We did not entreat the favor of the Lord our God, turning from our iniquities and reflecting on his fidelity, his trustworthiness, you see? So the Lord kept watch over this calamity until he brought it upon us. Indeed, the Lord our God is right in all that he has done, for we have disobeyed his voice. And now, O Lord our God, who brought your people out of the land of Egypt with a mighty hand and made your name renowned even to this day, notice his preoccupation with God looking good, we have sinned and we have done wickedly. O Lord, in view of all your righteous acts, let your anger and wrath, we pray, turn away from your city Jerusalem, your holy mountain, because of our sins and the iniquities of our ancestors. Jerusalem and your people have become a disgrace among all our neighbors. Now, therefore, O our God, listen to the prayer of your servant and to his supplication, and for your own sake, Lord, let your face shine upon your desolated sanctuary. Notice how many prophets do that? For your sake. The preoccupation of God's friends is with his reputation. The preoccupation of servants is, what has he done for us? We're in trouble. He's punishing us. Is there any way we can get out of this? Is there any way that our legal standing could be adjusted? And they seize on even the whole Christian explanation of the plan of salvation as God's way of making it possible to adjust the regrettable legal standing of these servants. Would one want to rather read the Bible as a servant or a friend? Daniel was a friend. Incline your ear, O my God, and hear. Open your eyes and look at our desolation and the city that bears your name. We do not present our supplication before you on the ground of our own righteousness, but on the ground of your great mercies. O Lord, hear. O Lord, forgive. O Lord, listen and act, and do not delay. For your own sake, O my God, because your city and your people bear your name, and you don't look good. Well, that's what Moses said, wasn't it? If you don't take your people into Canaan, you won't look good. And Daniel is saying the same thing Moses did. And then he goes on, while I was speaking, the word came from heaven that he was greatly beloved in the sight of God, and so on. And he was given not just confirmation that they'd go home at the end of the 70 years, but he got some more information about the future. So the end of the 70 years is not the end of God's plan for the Jews. There's much more yet to come. So hopefully, when they went home at the end of the 70 years and things went almost from bad to worse for a while, you remember? And some would wonder, why did he bring us home? Well, he's not through yet. Read Daniel. There's much more yet to come. Much more yet to come. Don't you think this would be reassuring, though, to the Jews who may have felt that there was little ground for trusting God anymore? 10 tribes lost to the north, another 2 in Babylon, little chance of going home. And he says, doesn't this confirm your faith in God and in his predictions? And now let me give you a few more. Well, let's consider for a moment the value of prophecies. What did you think after going through all 12 chapters, much of it given to prediction? What is the value of them?
I want to jump ahead to 11 just for a minute. It's probably the only chapter I didn't underline anything in.
It's difficult.
It was very difficult. Did it apply to that day? Are we looking at it and trying to apply it to today, and it was only chapter 11 suddenly was only meant for that day? Except for, of course, where you get into trouble with the evil king of Syria.
Yes. A great deal of prophetic explanation is drawn from the newspaper. I remember as a boy in England watching World War II brewing over in Europe. Well, I go back even further. When World War I was brewing, or had even started, my mother and father got engaged early during that war. And there was another couple they were friends with, and they got engaged too. But then all these things began happening, and in the newspapers, actually the journalists were quoting from Scripture, and they were describing this as Armageddon coming, and that the kings from the east were going to come up through Turkey, the sick man of the east, and so on. And so they decided that the end must be very near. So the other couple decided that close to the end, Jesus said, you know, woe to you when the end is very near, if you have babies and so on, in the Gospels. They decided not to marry. But my father's eye lit upon a verse that suggested we should occupy till he comes. And so he and my mother got married in 1917, for which we children have been very grateful. That was many years ago. But it was the influence of the newspapers at the time, because journalists were citing things from Scripture. Well, I saw that happen during World War II. As they said, well, this is it, this is it. And here we are all these years later. And I see people looking in the newspapers. And, for example, when Russia became more dominant, we mentioned this last time, they began to find Russia in the book of Ezekiel. Because the word, Hebrew word for Rosh, which can be translated captain, was in there. Well, Rosh is close enough, isn't it, to Russia? And so on. Well, people have had a heyday with the prophecies in the Bible, trying to match them with the news programs and the newspapers and so on. So there's a huge collection of interpretations of all these things. And chapter 11 is a real invitation there. So while we're trying to make up our minds, watching how people have changed their minds many times, what is the value of these predictions? What should we do with them if we're not entirely sure? Now, some students of the prophecies of Daniel think some of these have really worked out so well, they're pretty sure they know what they refer to, but they don't feel as confident about Daniel 11. Except the way it ends, he shall come to his end with no one to help him, and at that time Michael, the great prince, shall stand up, and then the end comes very quickly. Seems a little clearer from then on. Did Jesus himself ever comment on the purpose of predictions? Did he make predictions?
Yes.
Which have enjoyed much interpretation. In Matthew 24, for example, like, look at that. In Matthew 24:25, what the Lord would do with predictions would surely be of influence to us, wouldn't it? In 24:25, speaking of the troubles that would come, though he seems to be speaking of the destruction of Jerusalem again, he says, take note, I have told you beforehand. And then add to that, asking the question, why would he tell them beforehand? He adds some warnings and some signs. Then look at John 13:19. John 13:19. Again, he says, I tell you this now. Now, this is not the signs of the end of the world or the destruction of Jerusalem. This is about what Judas was going to do. I make a prediction here. I tell you this beforehand, so that when it does occur, you may believe that I am he. And, of course, believe, faith, trust are the same word. So, when this extraordinary thing happened, that one of the 12, whose feet Jesus had washed in the upper room and had shared in the Lord's Supper, was a traitor and really shocked the others by behaving the way he did, they remembered that Jesus had made the prediction. Just like when Jesus predicted that Peter would deny him three times before the cock crowed twice, Peter remembered that Jesus had predicted this, and it really did something to him. So don't we have the invitation here to think that the purpose of prediction is, we may not be exactly sure what it's predicting, but when it happens, you'll look back and say, aha, look how that works out. Have you had that happen in your own experience with these predictions? In John 14:29, again he says, now I have told you this before it occurs, so that when it does occur, you may believe, you may trust. So it was said several times. And of course, that we trust God is what the plan of salvation is all about. In the great controversy, this great struggle between good and evil, Christ and Satan, the war that began up in heaven, God's whole purpose is to win us back to trust, for God as our creator and physician can readily heal all the damage done if we trust him. So trust, faith, belief is what's stressed all through Scripture. And if the fulfillment of predictions, as we look back, not ahead, but look back, leads us to have greater confidence in the one who made them, this would be serving that purpose, wouldn't it? What about the Jews now? Didn't they have some reason to have their trust pretty severely tested during the Babylonian captivity. And Daniel says, but it's right on time. It's exactly what's predicted. This should confirm your trust, not undermine your trust. Now he says, let me give you some more. And he gave some predictions as to when the Messiah would come, right next to that. And now this would raise the question, did the Messiah come at that time? Christians say, yes, he did come at that time. And that would confirm the trust of many. And what about all these others? What after 70 AD, when Jerusalem was destroyed, devastated? What basis would the Jews have now to trust God? But had it been predicted, had Jesus said such things? What about predictions of what it will be like to live in the end time before Christ returns? Do we see that sort of thing? Does it dismay? Many religious people are utterly dismayed by what's happening in the world. But was it described in advance? Might it actually confirm what Ezekiel was saying? God is in control. I said it was going to happen. Don't you see it's happening the way I said? But you notice the main value is looking back, not looking ahead. Is that one of the main purposes of prediction? Because I have so many collections of nice, neat charts that have everything laid out exactly when they're going to happen, and they don't all match. And good people put these charts together. You probably have some too, don't you? But as I look back and see how some have worked out, I find it very compelling.
I guess what I wanted to know is, did it apply what was said? Is there a double meaning? Did it apply to back then?
Well, that's one of these questions of what to do with prediction. Is there a double meaning here? Mm-hmm. If so, how could you be sure? And if you can't be sure, then how could it give confirmation? If you say, well, maybe it means this and maybe it means that, and I find that very reassuring. Mm-hmm.